I'll tell you something funny about this collection. The first title was Too Jewish.
Oh my goodness, really?
Don't you think the stories are really too Jewish?
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Rabbi Zoe Klein, author of the new book of short stories, Candle, Feather, Wooden Spoon. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. The anti-Israel, pro-terrorist movement on college campuses, as well as the organized efforts to disrupt city council meetings and public spaces in America on behalf of Palestinian terrorism, well, it's finally waning, as colleges end semesters for the summer and encampments are disassembled. I've been asked several times this last week what I thought about the apparent young people's public embrace of the Palestinian cause, often in openly anti-Semitic ways that advocate violence and genocide of all Zionists and the killing of all Jews. First, I must note that the pro-Palestinian terrorist organizations that motivate and run these efforts on college campuses have been funded and largely created by large sums of money sent through devious channels from Qatar and Iran. These protests all use the same playbook, including the same chants, to simulate a popular movement. And the radical ideology that pretends that all Israelis, most of whom have darker skin, are colonials oppressing black and brown people has been ginned up by people funded by Arab and Middle East study centers, paid for by Arab oil and Iranian oil money. It's infuriating, to be sure. But there is another side to this story, the Jewish side, and it's not so great either. I'll start with a personal story, kind of al-chait, a public confession, and a comment on the way the organized American Jewish community has failed our Jewish youth on college campuses for many years. When I began serving 25 years ago as a senior rabbi in Tucson, Arizona, where I still live, my then synagogue was just a mile from the campus of the University of Arizona, then considered to be the finest university in the state. After rebuilding membership at my temple, dramatically upgrading the religious school and life cycle offerings, creating an early childhood education center and many other things, and developing a talented staff, I turned my attention to our older teens and college-age students, many of whom were attending the University of Arizona, the U of A. I was friends with the Reconstructionist rabbi who then assisted the director of the Hillel there. We were in a small morning running group, and I asked him regularly about the market penetration Hillel was achieving among the 6,000 or 7,000 Jewish students at the university, one of the largest Jewish student populations in the nation. It seemed as though most Jewish kids at college and most Jewish graduate students and administration and faculty did not engage with Hillel, the main Jewish campus organization at the U of A and on nearly every decent-sized college and university campus in North America. The statistics that Hillel boasted about at the University of Arizona reflected that failure to engage. Perhaps 1,000 at most Jewish students attended a Hillel Shabbat dinner or program over the course of the entire year. That was roughly 1 out of every 7 Jewish kids at school, not to mention the many other Jewish members of the university community who could have been involved but weren't. In response, I started to work on a program to connect students at the university with our synagogue, which was bikeable from campus, if not exactly walkable. I was young enough then to hang out with college students in coffee shops and cafes and, yes, bars, I guess. And we had an even younger assistant rabbi who certainly connected with the college and grad school age students and younger faculty. I reasoned that if Hillel wasn't reaching most of the students, and it surely wasn't reaching most of the Jewish students, shouldn't we help make Judaism in Israel a stronger influence on campus using our own synagogue's energy and effort? As we began, however, I received a call to meet with a major congregational and community donor. He told me that Hillel was raising funds for an expansion of its building, that Hillel was the organization empowered to connect college students to Judaism, not our synagogue. In other words, Rabbi Kohan, put your efforts elsewhere. This was not exactly a threat, but it implied one. You are trotting on somebody else's turf. That message was reinforced by the local Jewish Federation, now called Philanthropies, I think, which had beneficiary agencies, never synagogues, who had their own mandate. Other Jewish entities, like our temple, who did not receive Federation funding, still were not supposed to invade other areas or punishment would come in some way or another. Mind you, the amount of money that funded Hillel that came from Federation was never very large. There were always other things to put community philanthropy into, like paying the salaries of the people that worked at Federation. Still, they believed the university was Hillel's turf. We synagogues shouldn't try to engage students there except through Hillel. Well, since Hillel was missing at least 6 out of every 7 Jewish students, I thought this attitude absurd. That keeping rabbis from reaching out to college students and grad students and faculty was insane. But I had plenty to do in my 80 or 90 hour a week job at my own synagogue without putting effort and resources into campus Jewish life. I had only just managed then to wrestle adult Jewish education back where it belonged at the temple in my first couple of years on the job. I didn't really see how getting into some kind of community battle over college students would benefit us, or them, or anyone. So I redoubled my own efforts at outreach, bringing in people who wanted a connection to Judaism throughout the larger community of whatever age they were, with a lot of success. But I didn't really engage the university community directly, save for guest lecturing at an occasional class or holding an event on campus once every year or two. I had been warned off, and I decided not to fight that battle. Besides, Federation was already causing mischief with our own temple board. Now, that's just how our Jewish community here in Tucson worked. I can't speak for how it worked elsewhere, but I suspect it went similarly. We synagogues would keep our own students engaged in Jewish education and temple life and social justice through bar and bat mitzvah age and then all the way through high school, many of them teaching younger kids in our religious school until they graduated. Then they would complete high school and we'd send them off to college somewhere and kind of hope that Hillel would keep them connected to their Judaism. You know, we'd send them Hanukkah candles in December, Purim and Pesach treats in the spring, and regards from our rabbis and the temple sisterhood, emails, notes, social media messages. And once a year in December, after classes let out, we'd have a college Shabbat and invite all the kids back for a nice free dinner and Oneg Shabbat. That was it. Locally, we didn't really connect in any systematic or organized way with the many Jewish college students right here in Tucson. Now, since Hillel had such limited impact, the void in Jewish communal life at the University of Arizona was filled a tiny bit anyway with free Shabbat dinners at Chabad. You know, you could drink alcohol there. And random Orthodox rabbinic couples coming on campus to push observant Judaism from time to time. Jacks, I think it was called. And there was one Jewish fraternity. I was the chapter advisor at one point. And there were some Jewish students from the U coming to teach at local Hebrew schools and religious schools. But the larger issue, that a huge potential Jewish student population, perhaps 20% of the whole university population, was unconnected to its Judaism, well, that went unaddressed. Most Jewish kids were not connected to organized Judaism during their time at university, or if they went to grad school, or if they taught at the U. I suspect that that's very much what happened, and happens, everywhere in America, and probably in Canada too. That means that when our own youth are most impressionable, growing, changing the most, during their formative college years, when a lot of their attitudes are formed, most have no real connection to Judaism or Israel or synagogues. Which also means that when these organized efforts to destroy Israel and advance the Palestinian terrorist position and eliminate the only Jewish nation on earth and advocate the genocide of all Jews at times, well, the organized Jewish community of America is in an incredibly feeble position to respond on college campuses. Because our best allies, the Jewish kids we educated through their high school years and connected with and had in our youth groups, they have been cut adrift, essentially abandoned by us. And instead of dynamic pro-Israel organizations on campus and an excellent array of Jewish choices built by knowledgeable and talented young Jewish leaders and organizations and synagogues, we have the Hillel movement, laudable but so limited in its reach, and then a Chabad, whose Israeli members don't even serve in the Israeli army. And the response is predictably tepid and ineffective. That must change. The American Jewish community has serious resources at its disposal. What we need now is the vision to apply those resources to the marketplace of ideas that the university is supposed to be, to engage and recruit our own young Jewish adults in a serious and committed way. May we make those changes speedily and soon. Play us in this morning. Here's Shai Gabso singing Arim Roshi. I will lift up my head in spite of the present being hard, because my help will come, well, it will come from above.
להמשיך איתך את המסע ובצדדים הפחים כאילו איבדו את זהותם מחפשים עוד קרן אור שתעזור עוד לגימה קטנה של מים.
That was Arim Roshi by Shai Gabso, A Hope for the Future During a Difficult Present. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Zoe Klein, tells us why she chose to create her new book of wonderful short stories, Feather, Candle, Wooden Spoon, and how the new tales evolved into extraordinary explorations of identity and even belief. Find out when we come back in just a moment, right here on To Jewish. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs.
in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish a friend, Rabbi Zoe Klein, who has a beautiful book, Candle, Feather, Wooden Spoon, New Jewish Stories. Zoe is the rabbi of Temple Isaiah in Los Angeles, has previously written Drawing in the Dust, The Scroll of Anatea, and The Goblins of Nottingham. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. It's such an honor to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. What prompted you to create this book of new Jewish stories, which are genuinely new?
They are genuinely new. A lot of collections of Jewish stories are often retellings of old tales, but these are brand new stories. And I was prompted to write it. Really, I've been a rabbi for 26 years now.
Oh,
and you know that the rabbinate is filled with storytelling. It's just all spinning narratives, whether you're writing a sermon or even just responding to an email. You are engaged in storytelling. And so I compiled all of the different stories that I've been refining over the years and many new ones into this really special collection.
In Sandy Eisenberg Sasso's lovely introduction, she says that Jews are more storytellers than theologians, but there's some theology in here.
There absolutely is. One of my favorite stories is called Lace Theory, and it proposes this idea that God is a lace maker and that she is always weaving lace and we're all part of God's lace work. And when we transgress or do something wrong or break a relationship, the lace is torn. And essentially what we are as Jewish people are lace mentors. So we work alongside God in a covenantal way, mending this lace. And it's a really different kind of a theology of how we imagine what God does. I love the image of God kind of bent over this beautiful, antique, ongoing, eternal lace work and us being a part of mending it whenever it gets torn.
What a beautiful analogy. We will talk much more, maybe keep mending the lace with Rabbi Zoe Klein. Her book is Candle, Feather, Wooden Spoon, New Jewish Stories. When we come back in just a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a fabulous array of services, classes, and events this spring and summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the Tucson metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services Friday night and Saturday morning, or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests. Call 520-276-5675 for more information. Religious school is available for the coming year for school-aged children or grandchildren. Join us in the sixth year of our fabulous Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah programs, Torah Tykes experience, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha's services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Friday night services are at 6:30 p.m., followed by a delicious Oneg Shabbat. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. Services are at 10 a.m., all led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Our Facebook page, available for services, is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. And our Adult Education Academy classes are live and available on Zoom. Access those through the website, Beit Simcha Tucson. Our wonderful religious school is available. Also, you can register there on the website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more information about us, to attend services, religious school, and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, rich array of adult education academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and of course all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing Jewish congregation and community in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com, or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website. Streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. Over 200,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify, too. Post a rating, review 2Jewish where you listen to us. Those comments really help. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So last week we were speaking about your recent visit to France, and you managed to get into this famous synagogue in Carpentras, which is one of the really, it was actually quite an important Jewish community in the south of France, Provence. Carpentras Synagogue goes back to, I want to say the 13th century, might even be earlier than that.
At least the 13th century. And it is the oldest synagogue in France that still functions as a synagogue.
And one of the oldest in the world, actually, that still functions as a synagogue, although not the oldest. So tell us a little bit about it, because I've seen occasional pictures. I know some of the music of the Jews of Carpentras, because it's significant Sephardic Jewish community.
So first of all, the synagogue is in the heart of town. It's right, it's adjacent to the big market square where all the activity took place, because Jews were merchants. They participated in the mercantile life of the city. At one point, there was a ghetto there where the space allocated to the Jewish community was so small that they built houses as high as 10 stories. There is no building today in Carpentras that's more than two or three stories. I mean, it's funny to think that back in the 13th or 14th or 15th century, they might have had 10-story buildings there with obviously no elevator or anything.
Right, so that's a walk-up.
It was a hardship.
Yeah.
But the synagogue is extensive. Like many synagogues in that part of the world, it includes a communal oven for cholent, for the Sabbath.
For Shabbat food,
right,
and stuff. Right?
And a matzah oven.
Right, a separate one,
community
of course.
Baking matzah.
So you could make your Pesach food,
right,
there.
And a mikveh, which is attached to a flowing river, like a live river
so
flows through.
So it's real
through.
Mayim Chaim, real,
right,
living water.
Right. It's not our pathetic excuse for a mikveh. And this stuff, you know, it all reeks of antiquity. The actual sanctuary looks pretty modern. It does not look like a museum piece. And there are brass plates with engraved names on the seats. So that feels very modern.
That's pretty contemporary.
Right.
Yeah.
But the tour was extremely interesting because I think that the tour guide was probably the only other Jew there besides me. And what I was surprised at was this is way before the tour season.
And you said, I think off mic, there's like 50 people on this tour or something. I mean, it's quite
large. There were at least 50, maybe 60. I was surprised by the size of the crowd because A, this is before the tourist season. B, this was Monday afternoon, like in the middle of the day from 2 p.m. to roughly 3:30 or 4 maybe. And you have to reserve in advance and you have to pay and it's like a little bit of a hassle. So you have to really want to be there. They did take some walk-ins, which they never did before, but you know, maybe because it was the only tour that day and they couldn't say come back later, whatever. So the composition of the group was very interesting to me because Americans often think of France as a very anti-Semitic country, but the vast majority of people in this tour group were French people who were interested in the history of the synagogue, and they asked questions about certain Jewish practices like reading the Torah and observing Shabbat and what the function of a mikveh was and all, you know, all those things. They showed genuine and respectful curiosity, not a shred of hostility. There were a few foreigners. I think there were four Americans, other than me, who had a French-speaking guide with them who did a very good job and has obviously been in that synagogue many times before. She could have done the guided tour, but they were the only people who needed English, apparently. And the others might have included Belgians and Swiss and maybe some Germans, but they all were comfortable in French. And the tour was very detailed, and people followed carefully and showed no signs of impatience. And it was a wonderful experience because I'd been so frustrated over the years by not being able to get into this particular synagogue
yeah,
that was
yeah.
pretty near where I lived.
Well, I'm glad you finally made it. And if people are going to be in France sometime soon in Provence, do make reservations online in advance. Probably have someone with you who can speak French also.
Right.
Tom, thanks so much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Shmuel has a bad car accident with a large truck. In court later, the trucking company's fancy lawyer is cross-examining Shmuel. Judge, I'm trying to demonstrate some facts about this case that will establish that this man is a fraud. Mr. Shmuel, at the scene of the accident, didn't you say, I'm fine? Asked the lawyer. And Shmuel answers, well, like I was saying, I had just loaded my Moishele, my lovely hunt, into the car. My dog was driving down the highway when this huge truck and trailer ran the stop sign and smashed my car right in the side. I was thrown into one ditch and Moishele was thrown into the other. I was hurting real bad. I didn't want to move. But I heard Moishele moaning and groaning. I knew he was in terrible shape, the dog, just by his groans. Then a highway patrolman comes along. He hears Moishele moaning and groaning. He goes over to him. He looks at him, sees what terrible condition Moishele's in, takes out his gun, and shoots him between the eyes. Then the patrolman comes across the road, still in hand with his gun, looks at me and says, how you feeling? So I said, fine. Judge, what would you say? That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Bahar, next to last in the book of Leviticus, begins with a statement. God spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai, saying, a seemingly unambiguous phrase. The rules of holiness and personal conduct that follow must therefore have been commanded, Bahar Sinai, at Mount Sinai. And yet earlier in Leviticus, it's clear God has given most of these commandments not at Mount Sinai itself, but in the tabernacle in the wilderness, the Ohel Moed, at the Tent of Meeting, as the people wander in the desert long after they've left Mount Sinai and begun the journey to the Promised Land. As this portion of Bahar begins, the Israelites can't possibly still be at Mount Sinai at all. So what gives? Why say that these laws were given at Mount Sinai when clearly they weren't? The answer lies in the Torah's use of metaphor. In the rabbinic understanding, Mount Sinai is not just a geographical location, not a simple matter of a specific place at all. Wherever we learn and do mitzvot, whenever we complete ethical acts, do tzedakah, observe rituals with sanctity, study Torah, or work to perfect the world, wherever and whenever we strive to make this a holier, more Jewish place, then we stand at Mount Sinai. has committed Jews of every denomination. We take Mount Sinai with us, as it were, and so bring God's very presence into the world wherever we are. It's a powerful message indeed. We make our own lives as holy as the revelation at Mount Sinai simply by living the Torah each and every day through our own moral actions. A powerful message wherever we are. When we return in a moment, our guest, Rabbi Zoe Klein, explores why stories are just as important for adults as they are for children. And her collection, Feather, Candle, Wooden Spoon, is a wonderful book for adults to read and treasure. Find out why when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A group of 16 Republican senators asked the IRS last week to investigate nonprofits that support National Students for Justice in Palestine, the NSJP, including the group's fiscal sponsor, a New York nonprofit called Westpac. The senator's letter to IRS Commissioner Daniel Werfel says the agency should investigate whether, by directing funds to the NSJP, the nonprofits are supporting terrorism, which would violate their tax-exempt status. We should not need to remind you of the heinous support NSJP chapters across the country have voiced for Hamas, a U.S.-designated foreign terrorist organization, the letter says from the senators. That support has exploded at NSJP chapter-led demonstrations in recent weeks. The recent wave of pro-Palestinian campus demonstrations, many of them organized by SJP chapters, has made the investigation especially urgent, said Iowa Senator Joni Ernst, the letter's lead signatory. A range of Jewish groups have condemned the protests for targeting Jews with anti-Semitic rhetoric and creating a hostile atmosphere at schools all across the country. The anti-Semitism that has popped up on college campuses coast to coast is fundamentally un-American, Senator Ernst said. It is clear these organizations should not receive any favors from our government to do Iran-backed Hamas's bidding on our own shores. The senator's letter highlights just how closely they are scrutinizing the organizations known to be tied to the protest movement, which has strong anti-Semitic aspects. Other signatories included Senators Marco Rubio of Florida, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, Ted Cruz of Texas, and Mitt Romney of Utah. The letter cites a recent lawsuit filed by survivors of Hamas's October 7th attack, which states the NSJP collaborated with Hamas and has promoted its messaging in the months since the attack. It also refers to an existing investigation into one of the groups by Virginia's state attorney general. The letter comes 7 months after dozens of Jewish groups signed a letter in mid-October asking schools to withdraw funding for Students for Justice in Palestine due to its support for Hamas's attack. On October 12th, just 5 days after the murderous brutalities of October 7th, NSJP released a toolkit that lauded the October 7th invasion as a historic win. The senator's letter states that in the months since, the pro-Palestinian student group has continued to promote Hamas-Palestinian terrorists, including at campus protests. The other nonprofits named by the senators are the California-based Tides Foundation and Virginia's AJP Educational Foundation. Westpac's tax-exempt status allows it to support a number of pro-Palestinian terrorist groups. The organization, a nonprofit with the stated mission of current affairs education, quietly facilitates funding the NSJP along with Within Our Lifetime, which organizes frequent pro-Palestinian street protests, and endorsed Hamas's brutal terrorist atrocities. Westpac, which is chaired by an anti-Zionist Jewish guy named Howard Horowitz, Yimach Shmo, facilitates funding for the groups by acting as a fiscal sponsor that allows it to receive tax-exempt donations and grants for organizations that themselves do not have nonprofit status, like National Students for Justice for Palestine. The arrangement allows NSJP to keep its finances secret, out of public view, and doesn't require the fiscal sponsor to detail the funding it channels to the groups. The ADL says WESPAC sponsors at least 15 groups related to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, far more than it sponsors for any other cause. Among the other groups it sponsors are the U.S. Palestinian Community Network, the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network, the Palestinian Feminist Collective, and the Palestine Freedom Project. They all collect donations through WESPAC online. WESPAC has sponsored NSJP since at least 2019 and sponsored within our lifetime since 2020. In other news, in the Middle East, despite months of deteriorating relations and increasingly hostile rhetoric, the complete shutdown of trade between Turkey and Israel in the last weeks, came as a shock. The shutdown, which Turkey's Islamist-leaning president Recep Tayyip Erdogan announced May 3rd, is putting pressure on prices in Israel, cutting off a major trade route for kosher food, and affecting people on both corners of the Eastern Mediterranean, Turkey and Israel. The shutdown is one of the most sweeping steps taken by any country in opposing Israel's war against the Hamas-Palestinian terrorists of Gaza. Erdogan said trade will resume only when there is a permanent ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, the murderous Palestinian terrorist group that Erdogan supports. This also marks a significant breach for countries that have long had close ties and, until recently, resilient diplomatic relations despite significant periods of tension. In 2023, Turkey was Israel's fourth largest trading partner, responsible for billions of dollars of exports to Israel. As the world's seventh largest food producer, Turkey has been the main source of certain staples consumed in Israel, including pasta and chocolate. And the country's close proximity, 400 miles by sea between southern Turkey's largest port and Tel Aviv, has made Turkey a go-to source for both food and construction materials. Given the geographical proximity of Turkey, you could order something and in a couple of days you have it, explains Hay Eitan Cohen Yanarachak, a Turkish-born Jew and scholar of Turkey-Israel relations at Tel Aviv University. That was a huge plus for the Israeli businessman who preferred to do business with Turkey rather than with more distant destinations. To serve the Israeli market, more than 300 kosher-certified factories operate across Turkey. Before this embargo, at any given moment, around 20 Israeli mashkichim, kosher rabbinic certifiers, would visit Turkey to check on factories across the country, all the way from the Iranian border to the Aegean coast. Well, that's all ground to a halt, and Turkish factory owners and Israeli certification agencies are reconsidering those contracts. Some kosher foods require oversight just once or twice a year, so certain production runs could be salvaged if a ceasefire agreement is reached soon. But others, according to Jewish law, require frequent or even constant supervision. Such kosher standards are common in Haredi ultra-Orthodox communities. But even U.S. kosher supermarkets frequently stock goods produced in Turkey exported to the U.S. from Israel by Israel-based kosher brands. For other supplies, it would be very hard for Turkey to come back with strategic goods like steel, cement, aluminum, and other construction materials, Yarnashek said. Because these products are considered crucial for the country, I assume Turkey will not be able to return to the Israeli market in the same way, even if there is a U-turn. If an about-face in Erdogan's stance comes, it would mark a return to the norm in the history between Israel-Turkey relations. Turkey and Israel have long had close economic relations and have maintained largely positive diplomatic relations for decades, certainly did while Turkey was under the rule of secular parties in the 20th century. Relations have been rockier since Erdogan took over in the early 2000s, but even at their lowest points, like after the Mavi Marmara incident in 2010, when Israel raided a Turkish ship trying to breach Israel's blockade of Gaza, trade remained high. On October 6th, the day before Hamas terrorists brutally attacked Israel, diplomatic relations were at their highest point in years. Ambassadors had once again been exchanged between the two countries after the period following the Mavi Marmara. Erdogan spoke positively about his calls with Israeli President Isaac Herzog and was planning a trip to Israel. Yet, soon after October 7th, Erdogan pivoted towards Hamas, calling the group not terrorists but liberators and mujahideen, the Islamic term for holy warriors. Analysts interpreted Erdogan's stance as an appeal to conservative voters who gravitated towards the Turkish Islamist New Welfare Party, which loudly accused Erdogan of being too soft in support of Gaza and the Palestinians. In March, Erdogan's Justice and Development Party suffered its largest loss in 20 years, bleeding voters on the right. Soon after, Erdogan ramped up his pressure on Israel and announced the trade embargo. He further strained ties last week when, during a meeting with the Greek prime minister, he doubled down on his stance that Hamas was not a terror group and declared that over 1,000 Hamas fighters are being treated now in Turkish hospitals. He did not explain when or how they got to Turkey from Gaza. Still, there are glimmers of hope the trade ban may be short-lived. Formal ambassadors have not been reinstated, but low-level Israeli diplomats returned to Ankara this week. It's the first Israeli diplomatic presence in the Turkish capital since October. Turkish Jewish population has been declining for decades. There have been spurts of immigration leaving there when there are periods of political and economic instability in Turkey. Between 10 and 15,000 Jews live in Turkey today. And there's a mini crisis in the toddler YouTube world. The internet video phenom Miss Rachel, who is not Jewish, came out last week raising money in support of the UN's Save the Children's Fund, specifically mentioning helping children in Gaza, Sudan, the Congo, and Ukraine, but not Israel. Jewish moms and some dads are angered by this omission, since the Save the Children's Fund refuses to operate in Israel. And of course, among the hostages brutally taken by Hamas were Israeli children, including toddlers. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Rabbi Zoe Klein is the rabbi of Temple Isaiah in Los Angeles. And her new book is called, well, pretty new, is called Candle, Feather, Wooden Spoon, New Jewish Stories. It's a beautiful book and a fascinating one. You said something off air. I want you to repeat on air. Go ahead.
I said off air that every time I answer a question that you ask, I immediately, once I'm finished, think of a different answer to the question.
That's so Jewish. It's like, but on the other hand, this is Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof.
Yes, it's so true.
One of the aspects of Candle, Feather, Wooden Spoon that I happen to resonate to particularly was the way that you integrate Zohar, my favorite topic for deep study, the great Kabbalistic text from around 1300. Tell us how that came about for you.
So in one of the stories, The Radiant Window, A Zoharic Journey, there are a lot of Zohar quotes. And, you know, I have to say my fantasy has always been that people will read that story who have never studied Zohar and then be inspired to look more deeply into the Kabbalistic mystical tradition and texts. It's not something that we study a lot or refer to, and it's so rich. It's just strewn with jewels. So when I was in rabbinical school, I started studying Zohar. I read Isaiah Tishbe's three books on the Zohar, and they're very dense, and staying up all night and studying them and taking frantic notes and highlighting everything. And then I started cutting out sections of Zohar from my notes and pasting them together. And this story emerged from all of that, from this kind of pile of strips of paper covered in Zohar scribbles that I had made. And the original manuscript of that story was like a manic avalanche of Zohar quotes. I mean, the editor had to cull through them to leave the ones that are there. But originally, it was just like you could hardly get to the story because the Zohar.
It was all quotations. Yeah.
It was all quotations strung together by a little narrative. But it really emerged out of a deep dive into this phenomenal tradition. And I think the essence of it, the essence of the Zohar that I studied that I love so much, is the idea that that which is down low is modeled on that which is on high. So everything in our lives, not just the dirt, which is down low, is related to the stars, which is true, but also our very lives are a microcosm of the great, like, cosmos. And so everything we need to know about everything is, like, right here. So that story is sort of a journey into that discovery.
Really beautiful. As someone who's been studying, I want to say teaching, because I've been teaching it for like 20 years, but I'm not sure that I'm not still learning it while I teach it. Well, I am sure I'm still learning it as I teach it. It's beautiful. You do a beautiful job of kind of integrating it. People think that stories are for kids. That's true, but it's not the whole, shall we say, story.
That's such an interesting point, and I think that's been one of the interesting things about trying to market this book. It actually is right now a finalist for the Forward Indie Awards for Best Adult Fiction Book of the Year.
Yeah.
So in religious works. So that's interesting. A lot of people see that it's a book of short stories and immediately assume that it's for children. The truth is, it's really for a lot of ages. So there's some stories that might gear a little bit younger and some that are, you know, ageless or and can be older. But I think you're right that people shy away from short stories. The thing I love about short stories is there's a much smaller turn radius to get to the plot. You don't have the room to do deep inner monologues and, you know, thorough character development. And so there's a poetry aspect to it. There's a, you know, you have to conserve your words and choose them lightly. And then the reader gets to fill in the rest. You're dependent on that relationship with the reader. But the stories, I just will say one other thing is that, studies have shown that when you read a story, your brain waves, the wave dynamics change in the same way as when you travel. And so for adults, especially now as we're so deep in the thick of such tumultuous times, the best way to escape, to go somewhere, to get perspective on it all is to read. Is to learn stories. You know, social media only takes us deeper into the vortex of pain.
Right.
But stories actually allow us at all ages to travel.
The structure of the book includes questions at the end. Was that your idea? Was it an editor's idea?
So interestingly, the CCAR Press, which published the book, had never published a book of fiction before.
Oh my God.
Really? In the yeah. So it's the first book of fiction. And when I first proposed the book to them, they said, we love your writing, but we don't publish fiction. And I said, if you would indulge me, let me make a case for why you should consider publishing fiction. And I made the case that as an organization that educates and creates material and resources for rabbis and Jewish educators, cantors, the story is the most essential vehicle for transmitting values, right? So there's so many stories we tell in congregations over and over again, whether it's the rabbi who opens the pillow and the feathers go all over to teach about Lashon Hara, to teach about the gossiping and the pain of that. There's so many stories that carry values in a way that sticks, even more than, you know, any kind of just lesson might give. So I think the questions, I proposed that we could add questions to the end, and they really loved that idea. And that helped the book be a book that could fit into a lexicon of resources that the CCR presents. But I really love the questions. I think the questions invite conversation and relationship. And I love the idea of people wrestling with them. And there are some questions that are kind of simple, you know, what's a favorite Passover food or something like that. And then some that really delve deeper and encourage a kind of Torah study-like engagement.
There's a moment in the book, and one of the questions, I think it's on the story, maybe it's, the magic word, where it says, you quote Eric Fromm, creativity requires the courage to let go of certainties. There's a beautiful quality to stories that bring the kind of, as you said, it's like lace making, but it's kind of woven, right? You aren't totally, a story is a story. You're not sure where it's going a lot of times, which is one of the nice things about this book. The story's surprise. Is it nice not to have that certainty?
You know, not having certainty is scary. It can be really frightening. But it also, I believe, it's like that quote from Eric Fromm, is where creativity lies. You know, when you're uncertain, when you're afraid, when the Israelites step into the wilderness, they are a little bit lost, but they also are encountering a blank canvas. And, you know, it's scary to make the first brushstroke. But when you muster the courage to do so, you discover a lot about yourself. You know, you're not just traversing wildernesses. You're traversing areas of yourself that you were afraid to explore. And so I love that. I love that uncertainty. I've always been someone who appreciates people who take risks.
I want to thank Rabbi Zoe Klein for a risk-taking journey, but a marvelous book, Candle, Feather, Wooden Spoon, New Jewish Stories. Where can people go to find out more about you and to find out more about the book?
Well, you can find the book at the CCR Press website or anywhere really books are sold. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere you like to get your books. And I'm out there. So I would love to hear from people. I'd love to read emails or engage with people. If you get the book and you want to set up a Zoom with some of your friends to talk about a story or two, that would be wonderful. It's a wonderful story. Some people have set up Shabbat story discussions, just reading one story a week or a month. Very easy to do, but leads to a lot of good self and communal discovery.
It's terrific. Joey, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure.
Thank you so much. It's such an honor to be with you.
We will look forward to the next book, too, because I'm sure there's another one coming, because there's always more stories to tell.
Yes.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Reuven Fenton, New York Post star reporter and author of the new novel, Goyhood. And please join us at Beit Simcha every Friday night. Services and Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush in person and on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning comes from Lola Marsh, a reminder of the hostages still held by Hamas Palestinian terrorist Ad Shetachzor, until your return. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
ואם אתה שומע את קולי בחלום, אני לא אוותר עליך. והימים עוברים, והלילות קשים. הלב מדמם, והנפש שלי כבר שבורה.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.